Hello, all you young whippersnappers. My name's Malloy, and if you whet my whistle, I'd see my way to telling a story. No, not the one about the Mothman. This is a horse of a different color. About a strange concern fold in the air that turned out to be a door to another world. Now pull yourselves up a stool, and I'll tell you about these fellers named Greg and Toby, asking me all about this here New Century multiverse, after they took a trip through the wind dome. Greetings, all you lovely listeners that have come with us this far to Season 2 of Through the Wind Door, where we are going to do something that we have never done before. Talk about a different book!
There are other books in this series?
Jesus, you wouldn't think of it from all of the times that we went in and said, oh, we'll get into that later.
finally, I was just saying that to sound clever. There's actually others.
The things that we're getting into later finally include something other than Let Them Go. In fact, you could almost say that we have finally let go of Let Them Go. So, this is Secret Rooms that we're going to start discussing today. We're going to be discussing chapters 1 through 5 of Secret Rooms, the definitive edition. It's something we may have talked about previously, but this is not the original printing, so to speak, of this book, which is actually the second book that Alex ever wrote, the first being The Cartographer's Handbook. And as it turns out, it has been confirmed both through Toby, who listened to or read the original book, as well as by Alex himself, this first part one that chapters 1 through 5 encapsulate are not the original first 5 chapters of the story. Those of you that are familiar with Steamheart, the final book of Phase 1, know that most of the ensemble cast gets one or more scenes or even chapters devoted to their backstory. And when Alex got to the protagonists of this story, their backstory took up so much space to an already overflowing manuscript that he made a judgment call. Alex wasn't going to cut those chapters, but he was going to put them somewhere where they could properly be put into context. Thus was the definitive edition born, with 8 extra chapters added to Secret Rooms, a brief scene added to one of the existing chapters, and a few other small additions or deletions to make the rest of the book flow together with the backstory chapters. I don't remember exactly when I found all of this out. When I told Alex I was done with Let Them Go and wanted more, he just gave me a link to the definitive edition and let me go too. I remember being happy with the story overall, if a little frustrated, because I could tell there was a lot of setup for future books to resolve, as well as just the fact that it made reference time and time again to The Cartographer's Handbook without saying exactly what it was referring to. We'll eventually cover those moments during our recap, of course, but there was nothing in the text that made me think this wasn't the book as originally published. And while I have said that I prefer this version of the story, the simple truth is that I can't use those words, because as of time of recording, I have yet to read the original. That said, knowing exactly what was taken out and what was added, it does feel difficult to imagine a version of this novel without the backstory chapters. And a good portion of that recap will go into why I say that. But in brief, I feel like I would be more frustrated by certain aspects of the story if I knew only who Abigail and James are now and not who they were during their formative years. They are, after all, the protagonists. If Rebecca is the past, then our two heroes are the future, leading us into this new century, one might say, of... All joking aside, this is where we get into the real alternate history roots of Alex's series, and start unpacking what it means to turn post-Civil War Reconstruction instead into something closer to a post-zombie apocalypse Reconstruction. So let's dive right in, shall we?
Sorry, if I will just finish this thought and then pass the ball back to you. I think with the Definitive Edition, I mentioned last time that when I finished listening to Secret Rooms, the original edition, I liked it. I liked it a lot, and it was giving me more of a sense of where New Century was going. Mm. And then when I re-experienced the story through the Definitive Edition, I loved it, and I thought that it was a huge improvement on what was already a solid foundation. But I think the Definitive Edition brings into focus what this story is about, and it just enhances a lot of the best parts of the book. And the chapters we're going to be examining today are absolutely the, I think, better introduction if you weren't familiar with the state of things in this New Century.
I don't know. Same joke twice? Well, it'll be really funny if she does it a third time.
We've talked about why Let Them Go works so well as an introduction to the series, but Secret Rooms would definitely not be a bad alternative as an introduction. The thing I wanted to mention is that these chapters are absolutely a fantastic introduction to the principal characters, as you were talking about, because I think in the original edition of the book, it actually takes a while for you to realize that they are the main characters. And I think that that is certainly improved by having them be the focus of these, so that even when you're putting the focus onto other characters like Annie Oakley or Catherine Holloway, you do know that we are going to come back to James and Abigail. Throughout this set of episodes looking at the Definitive Edition of Secret Rooms, I think I will be coming in to say how the Definitive Edition sort of enhances not only the extra chapters, but the chapters that were already there, and how the extra context we have means, wow, that this moment means this because we know that. So I'm looking forward to that. And after interrupting and stealing the ball, I will hand it back to you.
No problem at all. But the other thing that occurs to me, when we say that these chapters were not in the original story, to get a little bit deeper into that without trying to spoil anything, one of the aspects of the final book of Phase 1... As clarification for new readers, we use the term phase to describe the narrative arc of a set of books because it was a shorthand that Alex himself adopted after it gained wide media appeal thanks to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It also serves a secondary use in that it primes readers to expect novels of diverse genres as well as eventual team-ups between the various protagonists of his stories, also like the MCU. Steamheart is introducing a large cast of characters, and as we go along, we hear about their stories very often through the individual books that Alex has written already, but in some cases, we don't necessarily see enough of them in order to get a real sense of them. You're going to see for yourself what we mean by all of this eventually, but that is months and even years off, so we'll stop digressing and get to the story at hand. But before we get into the meat of the story, we're going to talk about the opening poem. The experience of the beginning poem this time around is markedly more intense, simply because of the context of the poem itself. In Let Them Go, I already knew of Yeats's poetry, though not the poem in question, and therefore merely appreciated it as setting a tone for the story I was about to take in. Here, finding out what the name of this poem is and who wrote it all of a sudden dropped a whole bunch of contextual curiosity and layers of meaning onto it above and beyond the text itself, because this opening poem is called Where Once Poe Walked, and it's written by H.P. Lovecraft. I did not know that Edgar Allan Poe was an influence on H.P. Lovecraft, primarily because I never read all that much of either, although I know more overall of Poe's works than I do H.P. Lovecraft's works. Neither one of them are writing in the kind of genre that I would normally enjoy. Listening to the poem for the second time with a new appreciation for Gothic genres and tropes, meant that I was now primed to see secret rooms from a perspective that I had not previously considered. Prior to this, the story was no one genre alone, and had elements of alternate history, western, fantasy, and mystery. And the further I reread Secret Rooms, the more I realized just how many gothic roots it has that I had not keyed into. For example, I knew that mystery was a component of Lovecraft's books, but I didn't see Secret Rooms as being on that same level. I was wrong in that assumption, but that was because I had only skimmed the surface of it, literally focusing on the rooms aspect of the title, and not on all the secrets involved in the story.
It's a good title to draw you in, because as soon as all you have to do to a title is add the word secret, and people be interested, in much the same way that the old Marvel storyline of Secret Wars was, I think. Two words that the readers thought sounded cool and just smushed them together, and then it's like, Wars. Oh, okay, that sounds interesting. Secret Wars. Oh, I'm invested.
Now, having said all that, it's important for new listeners to understand that Alex's stories are not Lovecraftian. Those stories tend to be far bleaker in tone, which is the exact opposite of what Alex wants to write about. But in the case of how the poem relates, remember, this is Lovecraft talking about Poe, and having reviewed my own memory of Poe did The Pit and the Pendulum, and The Cask of Amontillado, and The Telltale Heart, and he also did The Mask of the Red Death, a story about trying to escape the plague. When I was originally saying this, I was not only referring to the idea of plague being thematic in New Century, but also obliquely making reference to COVID-19. I ended up cutting a good portion of conversation here that felt like we were making light of the pandemic, even from a gallows humor perspective. It's July now, and the piss-poor response to COVID-19, especially by US and UK governments, has already resulted in a lot of unnecessary harm. I don't even want to get into how bad it could get, and I certainly don't want to cause harm myself by being insensitive to those affected by the pandemic through physical health, mental health, or financial health. But because I am doing a podcast meant to entertain and take people out of themselves, I will include the last part of that conversation, where we get into a reason why New Century might be a good form of escapism during these difficult times.
One of the things that you might have seen around the internet, there is a notion going on during this time of everybody being in quarantine and a new normal and doing our best to weather this particular storm, where sometimes there are a lot of people watching stories or movies or other things about people dealing with some kind of calamitous event and trying to survive and work their way through it, and having that being unusually compelling even during a time of great unrest and confusion and strife going on right now in the real world. If you need something that is a cornerstone, a roadmap almost, for having difficult things coming down that changes your way of life and you don't know how you're going to come out of it, but there are heroes out there working towards making things better and giving you hope and feeling like something good could come out of this after all, there is no better thing that you could be reading right now or listening to than New Century. So,
So if you're a long-term fan enjoying this dive back into New Century or coming to the stories fresh, I hope that our podcast adds to the overall experience and lifts your spirits, because it sure has for us.
Yeah, there is absolutely a sense of motivation that I draw from this, and one of the chapters we'll be looking at today has probably one of my favorite moments in all of New Century, in that it is something that I think about regularly as a way of coping with thoughts that can wear me down and make me feel like the world can be too much at times. So that will be gone into later, which is a promise I'm so sorry I keep making, but it really will be. If you need something that can help you during such times, then yeah, this is the kind of story that really does help.
There isn't much more to say here in regards to the poem about Edgar Allan Poe that the text doesn't make clear. But in researching Poe a little further, one of the things that I had forgotten was that he had also written straight-up standard fare mysteries with his detective character DuPont, such as The Purloined Letter. That is going to be tangentially relevant in regards to one of our heroes, but it's not something that's covered in these first five chapters, so let us continue on. We get into the main proper of the story, and we are introduced to very young James. Well, not very young James Penrose. He's 13 at this point. James enters the story from a place of privilege, as his father is the kind of man that Charles Wolverton tried and failed to be in regards to personal wealth. This means that the relationship with his father is the primary focus of this first chapter, in regards to the kind of lessons that the elder Penrose tries to impart as a result of that wealth and status. But it is also showing that all this privilege didn't protect James and his family from the chaos caused by sickness and monsters, and one of the things we'll talk about is what James takes away from that. But first, there are a couple of allusions in the story specifically in regards to what things are named. It's the kind of thing that you wouldn't necessarily pay attention to if you were just reading casually, but the second I started doing my reread and re-listen to of Secret Rooms, I was like, okay, does this mean something in particular? One of the things mentioned in, like, I believe the very first few paragraphs of Chapter 1 was the story of the Ismalia coming into port and ostensibly bringing the sickness to the Americas. I looked into it a little bit myself, and Toby looked into it a great deal more about, like, what is the significance of the name Ismalia? We don't necessarily know that a ship with that name existed at that time, but it's hard not to believe that it didn't have some significance somewhere. Toby went in deep with this, if you go right ahead and share some of the things you learned.
So apparently the Ismalia is a city in Egypt, and as you pointed out, Greg, it kind of naturally invokes the idea of Egyptian rabies, so it's sort of like a portent to things to come. But from what I've read, the city is often sort of referred to and known as the city of beauty and enchantment within Egypt. And we know that it's meant to be 1873 when this takes place. Mm. From what I have read, the city of Ismalia was only founded in 1863, which would have only been 10 years before James boarded this ship. So
to clarify, when Toby says this ship, there was a brief confusion between the ship that brought the plague, the Ismalia, and the ship that the Penrose family traveled on to America, which was the Oceanic. This confusion wasn't apparent until the edit, so I've done my best to clean it up.
The ship would have been, you know, a very, very recent construction, and not only that, but it is named after something which is a very recent development in modern society. So, and it's also, the city was established as part of the construction of the Suez Canal. So all of that kind of comes together to make me feel like the Ismalia is meant to sort of represent the modern infrastructure of 1873. It's this very recent ship that is named after a very recent city, which was established as part of a completely new canal. Everything about it is to sort of show, look how grand and majestic all that technology is able to construct in this, the year of our Lord, 1873, is. It's very much a way to establish just how far civilization has come moments before we see civilization drop off completely when it all comes tumbling down with the Wendigo. And I think that it's one of those things where, given the motivation of like commerce and international trade that's behind the Suez Canal and then the Ismalia and then the ship, it's the sort of thing which embodies both the good and the bad of the infrastructure of the time. But for all of the faults of that, you're just left with what James appreciates about it, which is just progress for the sake of innovation. And I think that that's what James appreciates.
Well, that certainly dovetails with the ship that James and his family actually come over to the Americas on, which is the HMS Oceanic, which was a prestige liner. The one that comes up, should you look into the Oceanic, is actually the one that was crafted in 1899. The idea here is that Alex is trying to evoke the idea of the Titanic, because both the 1899 Oceanic and the Titanic were luxury passenger liners operated by the White Star Line. This metaphor is also meant to come into play when James is experiencing the Oceanic and talking about the clear divisions between the rich people and the lower classes inhabiting the various decks of it. You can't help but, you know, not picture the Titanic. And this is coming from somebody that's never actually seen the famous James Cameron movie Titanic. I can't necessarily explain to you why that is, except for maybe there was just so much hype around it that I was just turned off by the idea. But even then, you can't not know about things like the significance of class division and all that.
You're not alone in that. I only saw Titanic relatively recently, like a couple of years back. And again, it was one of those that so many people talk about it that even without seeing it, you feel like you've seen it. So that is not a uncommon circumstance you find yourself in. But please carry on.
As mentioned previously during our Let Them Go discussion, names have power. That's true whether we're talking about people, places, or things. Whether or not Alex was trying to deliberately invoke meaning, a safe bet in most circumstances, people will often assign meaning to things based on hearing the name of a thing, regardless of the namer's intentions. And given the next topic we wanted to discuss, the thing to point out is that our associations with these names are still influenced by the surrounding context. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. But people are still pattern-matching machines. If a good portion of the story feels like it is centered around showing some of the cracks and ugly constructions in the existing order, it is hard not to see everything as another dot on the graph that proves this assertion. We then take all this data and make value judgments that the already weakened and flawed order is understandably collapsing under the assault of the Wendigo, or, alternately, believe that the text itself is already making these value judgments, and we are just seeing it in the subtext. But there are complicated issues at play when we talk about the patterns that we see, and if we associate them with Alex and his intent. Alex is, after all, an open person that is not shy about talking about his past, his feelings, his values, and how all of those things relate to his various creative works. But because the remit for this particular episode is not about how Death of the Author works in the age of social media, I'm going to save this topic for another day, and merely suggest people check out a few relevant videos that I'll post links to in the show notes. Let us move instead to the topic of bad dads, and how those connect with the earlier topic of flawed old world order. It's something that's come up with Charles Wolverton and Let Them Go, and we've got some fresh examples here. In Chapter 1, when the senior Mr. Penrose is talking to James about how you relate to other people in terms of the baker's daughter, as well as how Mr. Penrose deals with other people in business, and how he will refuse to shake the hand of anyone who he considers his lesser, and that would seem to encapsulate a hell of a lot. One of the things that the story itself highlights is that James realizes that his father has never shook his hand.
Just breaks your heart, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, you came up with a parallel here from a piece of media that we both watched. In the movie Rocket Man, the biopic of one Reginald Dwight, a.k.a. Elton John, there is a moment that highlights an open wound between father and son that feels similar to James's realization about his own father.
So what's the phrase? It's, when are you going to hug me?
Yeah.
And it's one of those moments. The parallel between the two is the sense of the lack of human contact and how much that means to a son.
Or daughter, because we did get into how Charles Wolverton's rejection of Rebecca wounded her.
The sense that the father literally wants nothing to do, like he wants to keep himself distant from his son. And it's twisted because the tone of Alex's delivery when he plays Penrose Senior is this very nuanced place where he's definitely cold and distant and so, so toxic, but there is something in his voice where what he's saying to James really does sound like he believes what he's saying. Like he believes that this is the best advice I could give to my son. That this is actually exactly what a father and son relationship should be. And it's this twisted thing because it's like, is there a weird form of love there, even though it's so misplaced? Everything about it is heartbreaking because you see these two individuals and that impossible connection, which, as we see, never really comes to pass. It's just heartbreaking. I keep using that word, but it's because it is.
What Toby and I are trying to address here is that sometimes the bad parent isn't someone who is actively abusive or neglectful. Sometimes it's just that they are perpetuating behaviors and beliefs that are toxic both to their children's development, but also encouraging a toxic cycle that the children themselves will perpetuate, and as a result, potentially do harm to others. And it is possible to do all of this without malice. Let me further highlight this by relating my own experience with my father, since it feels in keeping with Alex's own openness. I had, and have, a great relationship with my father. Like, of people that have had difficult relationships on various levels, either with bad dads or distant dads or dads that people could not come to terms with for various things, I never had that issue with my own father. I mean, we've had our own problems, but we've always managed to work through them relatively well and come to a better understanding. And part of that, I believe, was his own experience with his father, which led to a concerted effort to try and avoid making those same mistakes with me. He wanted me to have the freedom to become whatever I was called to be, and part of that effort involved trying his best to impart all the useful information and wisdom he himself had gathered along the way. By and large, he succeeded, and if I have struggled along my own path to being an adult, it's not because my dad didn't do his best to teach and learn and teach some more. But by the same token, it doesn't change the fact that even as one is trying to do their best, you can still pass on ideas and behaviors or even emotions that cause negative side effects in your audience, even if that was never your intention. Something that comes up again and again in conversations that I've had over the years is the idea that good communication hinges on how one person interprets the output of another. And even under the best of circumstances, where one does his best to avoid traditional pitfalls, you cannot ultimately control how another interprets your communication. For a better explanation of this idea, let me defer to a section of a video by Innuendo Studios called "The Author is Absent."
Let's start with a word, like tree. Chances are if I say the word tree, you know what I'm talking about. Say I want to tell you about a specific tree, like, say, the one in the front yard of the house I grew up in. What can I tell you about it? Well, I can tell you that it was big. As a kid, the span of my arms could only go about a quarter of the way around the trunk, and the county required us at least once to prune it because the branches were touching the power lines. I can tell you how the bark felt to touch. It had this kind of grooved pattern, almost like tire treads, but rougher, and it felt almost crumbly, like if I ran my palm across it, I'd almost expect the bark to slough off in clods like dirt. I can tell you about the leaves, how they were a darker green than most of the other trees in the area, almost round but with a sharp point at the end, how they were smooth and waxy on the top, but the underside collected dust, which I'd compulsively wipe off with my thumb. What I can't do is take my experience of this tree and beam it telepathically into your brain, so I'm using language. I'm breaking down that experience into its constituent elements, colors, textures, images, sensations, translating those into words, and giving the words to you so you can translate them into your own set of sensations and try to reconstruct the thing that's in my head. Now, for this to work, it requires a certain commonality between us. Not just that you speak English and your vocabulary is such that you understand most of the words I'm using, but also commonality of experience. That you know what a dark green looks like, how tire treads feel, how far off the ground power lines are. And since the lived experience you associate with those words will never be identical to mine, the math won't entirely add up the same for you as it does for me. The reality is that the tree in your head is going to be different from mine. And since you also can't telepathically beam your tree into my head so I can compare it with mine, we may know that they're different, but we don't really know how. Now imagine instead of talking about my experience of a tree, I'm talking about far more subjective experiences, like pain, or doubt, or love, and you'll see what I'm getting at. Inside every brain are thoughts in a mother tongue spoken by only one person, and to speak and be heard is to go from one private language into a shared code, and then into another private language. The translation is always imperfect. The fact that human beings can communicate at all is sort of amazing. I mean, depending on how evocative I am with language, I can get you pretty close, but ultimately, communication is always settling for good enough. A big takeaway here is that the thing in your head is yours, or it's kind of ours. I supplied the blueprint, you supplied the materials, so in a sense we made it together, but since we built it in your head, and I'll never get to see it, you're the one who gets to keep it. And the point here is all communication is collaborative. Even when I'm the only one speaking, we make meaning together.
That may all seem a little long-winded. But the point I'm trying to make is that the concept of good enough is the result that occurs under the best of circumstances. What happens when the speaker is not aware of things like their own privilege? What if they are narcissistic or their empathy is broken? This is why the interactions between James and his father sent up a big red flag for Toby and I. As you say, Penrose Sr. may not even think about the overall implications of what it is he is teaching his son and why that's bad, because obviously he doesn't think it's bad, or at the very least he thinks it is protective of oneself to steel oneself, wall off any empathy for other people, and to keep yourself in a prominent place for selfish reasons. From that perspective, Vincent Penrose's interactions with his son make complete sense, at least to him. But selfishness is not what is going to be better for people, for relationships, for communities in general. And we see that as much now as is present in this past storyline here. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's some of the emotional stuff that comes up for me in relation to James and his father.
And it's even more significant that James steers away from this advice, as we see later on in the chapter, because the advice that his father is giving him, which is you must be above and beyond and detached from the people around you, the sort of those at the periphery, and given the way his mind works and the difficulty he has in sort of passing the information that he interprets from the faces of the people he interacts with, and that advice that his father would give him, it would be not necessarily easy to follow it, but you would not blame him for being predisposed to maybe seeing people as they should be at a distance, that he shouldn't try to sort of shake their hand and make that connection. The fact that James nevertheless does try to shake other people by the hand and to be at their level and to engage with them, even though he finds it more difficult than most do, I think speaks volumes as to his character and how he really has gone in this much healthier direction. It also kind of establishes everything you need to know about James, which is, for as calculating as he may appear, there is a desire to connect and an empathy there underneath everything. So you know that he is never far removed from the other members of the cast.
I like that you bring up the line from Rocket Man about hugging in particular. While there is no hugging specifically in these early chapters, there is a moment in Chapter 4 where Lucy is taking James's hand and encouraging Abigail to do the same. At the time, we don't see how James feels about it because the story is from Abigail's point of view. Chapter 5, however, highlights James's excitement about friendship being offered by girls his own age. People need physical contact, and I expect after being alone for so long, to be welcomed by a heretofore unexperienced level of intimacy was both new and deeply gratifying. Lucy accepted him as one of them, as au fait accompli, and that simple touch of the hand was the spark that led them toward developing deeper and more complex emotional connections in short order. The hug here is symbolic, rather than physical. That said, the most important contact is, as previously alluded to, the handshake with Catherine Holloway. In defiance of his father's advice, he accepts her hand in the spirit of cooperation and equality, and working together towards a common goal where all benefit. The fact that it is Catherine that offers the hand is also symbolic. We will see again and again how through words and actions and even her emotions, that she is one of the best representatives of the way we want people to be during times of crisis. Not without flaws, certainly, but because of what she represents to our heroes as a teacher and protector, she inspires the hope we all desperately need. That's part of the reason why her speech to the children is as potent as it is.
My name is Catherine, and you will address me as Miss Holloway. Now, I understand this has been quite an emotional week for all of you, and I will not lie, that is unlikely to change today. You are the last group we will be taking in here at Weirwood. These children of Buckley and Coltsburg make up the rest. We'll show you how to work. You are here for the time being because it is the safest place. We grow our own food. There's clean water from the creek, and as of today, just enough room for all of us. Now, listen very carefully to what I'm about to say. My staff are right now closing and locking the gates of the high perimeter wall bordering the estate. This wall has been fortified to keep out the goblins, as have the gates. Adults will leave on hunting trips and scout for supplies and trade in neighboring areas. You will most likely live in this house for many years, and whilst you do, it is absolutely forbidden for anyone to set foot outside the gates without my permission. This is to prevent you coming to harm, but more importantly, it is an unbreakable rule set in place to keep out infection. If we are careful, and if we are lucky, the epidemic will not reach us here, and the U.S. Army will have a victory. If we're even luckier, then when it is safe to return to our homes, the families we have left behind will greet us with open arms. Hold on to that thought. It will keep you going when things are hardest. But do not forget this. We all are blessed to be here, healthy and alive for the time being. Whatever happens, we are the ones who were loved.
Listening to that again, especially with the music at the end, makes me tear up a little. A separate part of my brain is also extremely frustrated that we don't have someone like Catherine holding the reins of power during this time of COVID-19. But real-world parallels aside, she will go on throughout the book and beyond to leave a lasting impression on the reader. At least, she did for us.
She's good. She's good to have around.
Jumping off from that, do you associate the character of Catherine Holloway with any other notable fictional characters?
It's hard because one thing I'll note about Catherine Holloway right now is that she's one of the, I think the only character, though I may be mistaken, who has actually had two different people voice them. Originally, she was voiced by Sharon.
The speaking parts were later recast with frequent School of Movies participant Maya Santandrea, specifically as a part of the update from the original audio drama to the definitive edition.
To answer your question, unfortunately, I'm coming up short. She does, in some ways, strike me as... You know, actually, I have it, and I know for a fact that you haven't read or watched this series, so I apologize, but she is a bit like Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter series.
Oh, okay.
And depending on how you see McGonagall or Catherine, they might go, really, are you sure about that? But I would say it's because, well, McGonagall is someone that isn't going to coddle you if you do something stupid, but she does take very seriously her responsibility to keep the children under her care safe. She's also a creative thinker, and that inspires other characters to trust her. But anyway, that's my off-the-cuff response. Do you have any fictional characters that she reminds you of?
When I initially answered this question, my own knee-jerk response was that Catherine reminded me of Ellen Ripley. It felt a little bit like a cheap answer, as Ripley was already brought up as a touchstone for Let Them Go, due to the names of Amanda and Rebecca being references to her daughters, and the image on the cover being inspired by Ellen suiting up for battle in Act 3 of Aliens. But that doesn't actually make it a bad answer. Just like Ellen, Catherine steps forward to be a leader after things have gone horribly wrong. She is a surrogate mother figure to our heroes, an experienced organizer, and she inspires others to be their best selves. And she is still very much human, allowing herself to feel and occasionally break down just like Ellen. Months later, as I edit this, another character comes to mind, Furiosa, someone who is wounded by past tragedy, but has risen above it to lead those she cares about to safety, and still able to reach out to others along the way. Of course, Catherine existed as a character long before Fury Road came out. The thing to understand, however, is that most of her characterization actually comes from these new chapters added to the definitive edition, and were written after Alex would have had a chance to see Fury Road. So it's not impossible that Furiosa could have influenced this writing. There is an additional thing to consider. I think when they came up with the idea of Weirwood and Catherine Holloway being the matron of it, particularly since it's present in the South, there was meant to be some invocation of Gone with the Wind in terms of that big house in the South and the female protagonist in that story. Gone with the Wind is one of those pieces of media that I've never experienced either, and I'm not really sure that I would enjoy it that much now since it is so very dated. And
it is also so very long, if I remember correctly.
At time of writing, we've already had The Tempest in a Teapot, where Gone with the Wind was taken off the HBO Max streaming platform and then re-added with a disclaimer about the problematic content of a movie that, back in 1939, won 10 Academy Awards. I am unlikely to ever see this movie, so I can't speak at all to how the story of Weirwood could be a subversion of Gone with the Wind. But I do know that Alex intended it that way, so I included it as part of the paratext when discussing Catherine. For now, let us move on from that topic, and instead reflect on our description of Catherine being a Paragon character as relates to an earlier discussion.
One of the things that James's father quotes to him was that you must be the best of men or be no man at all. If someone said that to me, then I would associate certain values with that. That would be far more positive overall. But I feel like when James's father is saying it, he is trying to espouse being the best of men is literally being a man that is above and beyond other people in the sense that you are richer, you are more powerful,
and you must reach the upper echelons of success, or you are nothing.
Are you on the leaderboard, son?
Yeah, this kind of competitive masculine bullshit really grinds my gears. For myself, and for the men I most respect, financial success or some form of power over others is not the end goal, or even a goal worth attaining. Because we should be so far beyond might makes right, and the notion that success as a man is a zero-sum game. I don't want to be the best of men. I am satisfied with being a good man, and I define such as someone that does his best to be compassionate, empathetic, and always working towards goals that will lift people up and reduce harm. And maybe I don't always succeed, but that's okay too, as long as I am always working towards being better today than I was yesterday.
There is a world of difference between wanting to be better and wanting to be the best.
Your comment about the leaderboard there is very telling, I would say. So when we have that moment where James is shaking Catherine's hand and making that deal, it feels like that is the
not quite the repudiation, but instead redefining his father's words into a context that makes sense to him, reclaiming it as something good rather than something toxic. In doing so, he is on the path to actually being a better man than his father. Hell, when we are first introduced to James, we can already tell that he is highly intellectually intelligent, what with the background details about him being smarter than his tutors, and the very savvy conversation between father and son. What James lacks is experience, socialization, and practical application. And even with that taken into consideration, he is still managing to make good decisions every step of the way, including accepting Catherine's hand of friendship.
I think when he's asking his father the questions, it's almost like he's more interested not in getting the answers from his father, but he's more interested in seeing what his father thinks and understanding his father more. The fact that he observes, wait a minute, he's never shaken me by the hand, is kind of the only thing we hear that James thinks about following this conversation. It's not a case of, I would have to turn this over in my head and decide if I thought so or not. He doesn't even seem to be considering whether he should follow that. He's sort of here thinking, well, this is very interesting that you say that, because I know this other thing about you, and it's making me realize something else about you.
Yeah, he's not looking for answers, he's looking for data. And then he's going to collate all of that data and come up with his own conclusions.
Completely.
All right. Well, we've wandered around a little bit here, but I feel like on some level we still haven't gotten off of chapter one there. So let's
chapter
proceed.
Chapter one.
Oh, okay. Now it's been an hour and a half later. We just finished chapter one. Goodness knows how long the rest of this is going to take. We kid, of course, but 40 minutes is still a long time to discuss the elements in a single chapter when we've got four more to go. So let's pick up the pace. Let's proceed on to discussing Abigail's situation more, because in a very real way, favorite character here. I mean, I have my favorite character in New Century depends on what I'm reading at the time and just remembering, oh yeah, there was this great moment, and oh yeah, there was that great moment, but our first introduction to Abigail, where she is literally punching a boy in the face as a result of him being a privileged little shit, that's just like, oh my goodness, yes, this is everything that I want in a heroine. In the words of the We Hate Movies podcast, which Alex himself loves to quote all the time,
A+, A+.
Well, they should
have just an A+.
She likes punching.
Yeah, she likes punching. Punch everybody, Abigail.
He sees the dialogue tree, and the renegade option is just always hovering there.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yes, exactly. Of course, as we get to know more about Abigail and her conversations with her father and her mother, one of the best moments of that particular interaction is once they get a sense of how she feels about all this, why she did what she did, what her thinking going on under the hood is, her father's like, if this happens again, then you have my permission to punch him twice and kick him in the nads for good measure. So it's just like, this is almost the polar opposite in terms of relationship to family. James has a distant father who is teaching him things but not teaching him good things, and while his mother is there, she is on some levels almost a non-entity. Like, you know, she does things for him and she asks things of him, but we don't really get a good sense of who she is as a person other than just being a rich man's wife. When we find out more about Abigail's parents, there is a whole lot more texture of stuff going on there as we learn that her mother was a prostitute and her situation where she was fine being a prostitute for a while and doesn't view it as being a bad thing, and her husband doesn't view it as being a bad thing, but nevertheless acknowledges that the circumstances which often lead women to be in the sex trade, even and especially at that time in history, is usually not the best of circumstances. Alex is therefore able to put into the world a progressive take on sex work through the mouths of his characters. I appreciate that immensely. Some might argue, of course, that this isn't historically accurate. My response to that is, first of all, those people are usually hate boys, and fuck them. But more importantly, I prefer stories that encourage values I want to see normalized in our society. Which is good, because Alex does that a lot, especially in this very chapter. Abigail goes on to confront her father about the choices he made in regards to joining up with the Confederate Army, and coming back to that conversation now especially carries a lot more difficult weight behind it. I'm not saying the conversation shouldn't have happened. Responding critically to our history is something that should have been happening a lot more, a lot earlier. And the youngest generation has been especially vocal in regards to calling out those in power. Young Abigail is speaking for all of us when she says that she cannot accept the explanation given. Abigail's parents are not necessarily wrong in what they say, that the world is complicated and sometimes you end up hurting without intending to. But the bare minimum we should do is stop letting outright propaganda stand unchallenged. When this scene was written originally, it was meant for Steamheart, which meant that it was written at the beginning of Trump's first term, already 2 to 3 years after Ferguson in 2015, after Bree Newsom climbed a flagpole in South Carolina in order to take down the Confederate flag that was being displayed in front of the damn State House. We had only started down a path that most of us knew was going to be very, very dark before the end. Now it's 2020. We have a new surge of protests because of state-sanctioned violence on black people. People are tearing down Confederate statues and flags that should have been removed years ago after Ferguson. The powers that be are still using cops and even the National Guard to try and suppress dissent, while white supremacist militias are given free rein to terrorize and even potentially kill. In some places, black people are being lynched, and the police are trying to claim that they're all somehow suicides. It feels like we are having a slow-moving second civil war, except this time we don't have a president and an administration that is able to combat it. It is, instead, the enemy. And maybe it only hasn't gotten worse because of the fucking pandemic going on, which is its own disaster. What I mean is, if there is anything frustrating about the scene, it's that it feels like it doesn't go far enough. That said, this chapter is meant to outline the formation of Abigail's morality, and not to be a commentary on America or humanity. That is a topic for a later time. As it stands, while Toby and I will never shy away from being political, just like Alex, the conversation has gotten a little grim due to the topic of the story reminding us a little too much of real-world fuckery. This podcast is meant to entertain rather than bring people down, so for now, let us put a pin in Secret Rooms and come back fresh in 1 week for part 2 of our discussion of the first 5 chapters. And to end on a high note, let me also share with you another favorite song that I was introduced to last year. It was originally in the Borderlands 3 trailer, and I was going to save it for a future White Scarves team-up due to the contents of its lyrics. But right now, I think we could all use a pick-me-up. So let me give you the DJ known as Grizz, and featured vocalist Tash Neal, doing an intense and morale-boosting track off his album Good Will Prevail. I give you Can't Hold Me Down.